I'm so confused.
We're in the cold open right now.
No, we're not in. We're not even there yet. This is a huge disaster.
Just bring up something unrelated.
Here's how I do that.
Okay.
Man, Keisha, it's finally good to get a black person in here.
Oh, am I the first?
Mm-hmm. That what? I've interviewed, but technically because I'm here, there's a black person every day.
Yep.
But I think that I'm really mad. We were talking earlier, I forgot to solicit questions early enough to get like a bunch of questions. I was assuming that I would get every black student that has like questions that, here's why I assume this. None of this might not even be the cold open, but the reason I was asking that is because like, anytime I run into a black student in the hallways of this training center, they corner me and ask me a question like, hey, man, like, how do you, like, they ask me questions like I'm the only one that can answer it for them. Do you get that at all, Keisha?
Oh, I have a lot of students who are involved in the diversity and program in some respect come up to me. And I think it's very interesting because I think they're looking for some sense of community and identity.
Yeah.
So I try to be as warm and inviting. And, oh, boy. Yeah, I invite people to talk to, I invite people to talk to me.
Yeah.
And I'd like to continue to invite people to talk to me because a lot of people have experienced questions that they're trying to negotiate as they learn this skill of improv.
I don't always feel like I have to answer students sometimes in the hallway. I might give like a half answer and try to get back in the teacher's lounge. But there's something about them black students. I got to answer them. I have a student named Leon, probably listening to this. I answer all his questions.
That's good. I mean, I think it's important that a lot of people have role models that look like them and that visual representation of people who look like them, even not just identifying as black. I'm also a woman.
That's true.
I'm self-identified as a woman.
That's
so
true.
I'm more things. And I think I also have a lot of female students who come up to me, a lot of women of color, people with just difference compared to the normal UCB student body who come up to me and ask me all sorts of questions. And I try to answer them as best I can. Like I'll chit chat with older students and talk about their like experience in class and try to give them a keep going.
I mean, Dressable, do you have the same experience?
Yeah, for sure. I think as it's like much, it's different because it's as a woman. But I also think that like just in the time that I've been at UCB, there are so many more women than there used to be.
Totally.
So there are lots of people to to talk to.
I'll say one thing about UCB, got lots of great role models. That's a long form conversation.
Oh, boy.
Recorded at UCB Comedy Studios in New York City. This is the Long Form Conversations Podcast with your hosts, Sean Diston and Nicole Dressbell.
All right.
There's no way that's the cold open. That was like what would normally be the most interesting thing that we would get to on the podcast.
Now, here's the thing is you guys think that that was a joke. I was being completely genuine. There are great role models at the UCB.
Yeah, yeah.
Did that seem like it was a joke?
No. It was transition. Because usually it's like, we're talking bullshit. We're talking garbage. And that's a long form podcast.
Sometimes you just got to switch it up. You know what I'm saying?
I know.
We weren't questioning your sincerity.
Okay.
It
was just that was a crazy place to make the cold open because, Jesus, we were getting into some heavy stuff. Well, and I'm sure we're going to get back into it because our guest today is, I would say, incredible role model. I mean, someone that I know that personally, she teaches high school students how to do improv. She's been an educator for most of her life. I mean, maybe not most of her life, but an incredible improviser, great role model. We've talked about her in many podcasts, doppelganger, amazing. Keisha Zoller is here. Zoller.
Like dollar bill.
One great thing about this podcast is we're learning how to pronounce everyone's names, Nicole Dressbell.
That's true. So I know we normally start this with that like goofy who, what,
where
thing.
Please, let's jump back into
but
it.
But I think like we're having an interesting conversation. I think like I would be more interested in keeping the thread of this and then like
go for it.
We'll figure out the other
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, we'll jump back into the who, what, where, but let's get right into what we were talking about there.
So Keisha, how long have you been teaching?
I've been teaching since 2012.
At UCB.
Yeah, at UCB. Right. And probably coaching also before that.
I was coaching before that and doing experimental stuff in the East Village for a while and doing all sorts of crazy stuff.
So you've been a resource for people for a long time then.
I've tried. I really try. I have a strong belief in community and support and that like, so everybody's had that moment where you're like, I want to give up. And you hear that one piece of information, that one praise that like gets to the heart of what you're feeling and like is just enough to keep you going.
Yeah.
So I really think that's important to do for each other. Like, because you see people who you're like, you're awesome.
Yeah.
It's gonna happen. Whatever your dreams are, they're gonna happen. Just push a little harder, and I'm here to help motivate you to that.
Do you feel like you've been saying the same things the whole time, or like the conversations you have evolved? Is like you've evolved and your perspective has changed?
Oh, yeah. I don't say the same things. Like one of the things I may not slam dunk every time. I really try for authenticity. So
yeah.
Sometimes that means I'm not necessarily saying the right thing, but I'm trying to give the right thing because sometimes words are tricky and messy.
Exactly.
And it sounds, what you say sounds counterintuitive to what you're trying to speak to. So I feel like I try to be nuanced and present with the people I'm talking to when they express struggle or we're chit-chatting about the process or learning or whatever. So I feel like as my sense of self has evolved, my answer has evolved. I think I had a very different point of view. And even as an adult, as I do more writings around feminism, womanism, different dynamics, I feel like I've radically changed my point of view. And from, I don't want to say it was more assimilist. Like I wanted to be encourage students to assimilate. Now
right.
I think I want to encourage everyone to take up their own space and for other people to respect that someone taking up their own space will not look like the majority or yours, and that's okay. And there's room for that and to have courage to do that.
Let's give a little bit of background on this. So Keisha, you've been a huge part of the diversity program at UCB since its inception, right?
A year after.
Caitlin Steitzer might have been
Caitlin
the first.
Caitlin Steitzer, yeah.
And you took over with Eric Tenoy and others who have been a help of that. And you've been a huge part of that, the scholarship program, the actual meetings. And like you have done, I will say like the meetings I'd gone to, I'd always be impressed by how many people came and just the sense of community. And like, there is this sort of encouragement. I mean, you've had the Soul Glow show with the Jam, and there are a lot of people that I think are still doing comedy. I'm not sure directly. I'm sure that there are people that are still doing comedy based on just some of those things, you know? And, so you're saying like the diversity scholarship, how long ago were you doing that? And how long have you been a part of that?
So it started in, I believe I took over in 2009, 2010, and we, like, my desire was to create community and opportunity. It's true, I'm not trying to equivocate in this sense, but oftentimes women, people of color, people who don't associate in the gender binary per se or part of the LGBTQ plus community get asked to practice less.
Right.
They get asked to socialize less.
Right.
And it's not, I don't believe it's a cruel thing. I think it's one of those, sometimes there's an invisibility.
Yep. Like they don't know that they're excluding people, but in just their normal practices, they don't understand that they are.
Exactly.
And it's more about the perspective of the person being excluded and how to like minimize those things, you know, like I totally agree. As a person of color coming up, that was something I thought about. Maybe not as much. And I'll say, you were saying that this is something that, like, we don't always want to say, like, that's how it is in the comedy community. But one reason I think we can is because if you've been around the community, you've seen huge change.
Yes.
Like in the last how X amount of years, we've seen some huge, big changes.
Well, and it's always surprising to me because I'll hear people still give authentic critique to what they see missing and the balances they want. And there is part of me is like, we've still come away. We have a long way to go. I'm not invalidating your point of view. However, we have greater representation. Is it perfect? No. Will it ever be perfect? Not in my lifetime. Like, I can humbly say I genuinely don't. There's larger systematic issues.
Yeah, like
at
solving
play.
It in the comedy level isn't really going to solve the problem, really.
Yeah, I was actually, there's a interesting workshop called the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. And one of the things they do is they create workshops, and it's all about undoing racism, that racism is something that was actively done to us, and it is something that can be actively undone by truly understanding how it dehumanizes people. And one of the things that I think happens in the comedy community or artistic communities, we think we're above the systematic oppression that exists in the world. We think we're above all the gender stereotypes.
Because in
the
grand scheme of things, we're all the way, we're very
left
liberal.
And we're creative, when a lot of what we do serves that. And we have to be honest with ourselves when we're a part of the, whether it's the comedy community or any other artistic community, that we are involved in that.
Right.
And that's a hard conversation because we all want to be likable. Mm-hmm. I want to be likable.
Yeah. Likable, and also I think a big part of being in improv is like thinking of yourself as an underdog anywhere else.
Yes.
So to then like end up in this sphere where like you're not going to be an underdog, you definitely though don't want to think of yourself as a person in a position of power,
right?
Or as like the bullies that you worried about outside of it.
And I will also say, when I came to UCB, there was this feeling, and I think a lot of people have this feeling of, I found my people.
Yeah.
So like to have that feeling and then still experience some of the like systematic oppression, it kind of is disheartening to, I think, certain students. I think I might have been lucky that I didn't necessarily have to deal with it as much, but I mean, there's varying levels of, you know, that kind of thing going through even now or years ago. But I do think it's an important topic. I'm glad we started with this topic because I think you've done so much, Keisha, just keeping the conversation going.
Yes, I'm authentically, I love it because I think one of the things that happens is I hate the idea of diversity being other, when I think everybody, and to bring this back to improv, has their own unique experience that's amazing and interesting and specific. However, we still have to be aware that the rest of society has helped influence and shape that, and that people come bringing
that
all these ideas, and good intentions are one thing. It's opening our awareness and being mindful. I think that's very important.
And I think it's something that you said touched on this for me, is I think sometimes we think of diversity as like bonus. There was a little while we were talking about the diversity program as like a thing that might work. But in actuality, it's like vital, especially if a community itself is going to get better, but also like if art is going to get better.
Yes.
Sameness of perspective, sameness of experience is dull.
Well, and
not just dull, but dishonest.
Right. It is dishonest. One of the things that I've been railing against lately is this construct of mainstream. Because I was like, this idea of mainstream just means playing into the power that's always been in power and had representation. However, that's not the majority of people.
Right.
That the world is not, like, women, people of color, LGBTQ+ community, like people over 35. Wait a minute. We are the majority. Why aren't we the mainstream?
Right.
Why aren't those narratives mainstream?
Right. Things we call mainstream right now are kind of, in a way, directed towards a very specific mainstream.
Yes. Yeah. And so I encourage people to actively reject it because that's just not true. It's a lie we tell ourselves. We can tear it down comedically that, like, your voice is valid, unique, specific. Find your audience and realize there are people who relate to you. The people who are over 50 doing improv, here's the truth. There's a large majority of them. They have a lot of unique things to say that may not play to us millennials
right.
the same way. However, I hope they have a space and find a space and community where they can speak to their voice and realize that they have incredible value.
Yeah.
And I think, like, for me, it's this concept of mainstream. It's, I don't know, I feel like it's a term we don't need anymore.
It's very interesting, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Because basically what we're saying is like, oh yeah, like diversity students, in order for you to get good, you should get good at this thing that we all agree on is the way to do it. Where, you know, and I think in the last few years, we've started to see those representations on stage with Astronomy Club and Take It Personal and these shows where like, oh shit, this could be improv too. And it's just as valid and it's more unique, you know, it's unique and interesting. But let's go back a little bit because I don't want to skip through the beginning. Normally, Keisha, when we start these interviews, we ask a very specific question, Nicole.
So before you started taking classes at UCB, who were you? Where were you?
And what were you doing? Matching.
That's not
who was I? Before I started taking classes at UCB, I was an actor, a very serious actor who just finished up my MFA program at the Actors Studio.
Oh, awesome.
And I spent a lot of time in my body. I anecdotally say crying in a chair. Anybody who studies Strasbourg, you know. And I went to, actually, Ben Remeka was in the same program I was in.
Oh, interesting.
He was a third year when I was a first year. I remember his thesis. He was the gentleman caller from Class Menagerie.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You're like, yep, that feels right. And I had all these amazing experiences. Like, I've been in James Lipton's house.
Ooh.
Oh, right. I think he told me this one time.
I've seen portraits of his, I saw a portrait of his wife in nude, a nude portrait of his wife. It was as, like, his wife used to be a supermodel, so she's a stunning, elegant woman. My favorite moment, though, as I was in James Lipton's house, he said, as you could see, this is a portrait of my wife, Katakai, in nude. And this sofa, her nipples were matched to the sofa. So the nipples and the sofa matched.
Wow.
And
stop, I have to ask a question. I have to ask a question.
It was amazing.
Does that mean they went shot? Because so obviously the nipples came first.
Yes.
So does that mean they like.
No, wait. Maybe they bought the couch and said color correct this painting
nope,
to
the painting.
No. And I think it sounds like what he's saying is like this couch and her nipples, not just in the painting, but in life, unless I'm wrong. Match, right?
I didn't go that far. I never
thought
of
my
that.
Mind. Oh, in my mind, when they went shopping for a couch, they had a nipple sample.
In my mind, I wouldn't be surprised. Like, here's the thing. James Lipton is everything you think he is.
An eccentric.
God bless.
Man.
I have a letter he wrote me because I directed a show for Black History Month. It was a really good show. It was all about how Hattie McDaniel got her Oscar, but it was an imagined conversation between her and the producer saying, hey, we're going to get you an Oscar, but you can't go to the premiere. And it was this like beautiful one-act short play. Anyway, James Lipton wrote me a letter. I have it signed. I still have it. And it's something to the effect, your contributions to Black History Month have changed this institution forever.
Amazing.
And anytime I feel sad about myself,
you just go read that his voice. You say it out loud.
I say it out loud to myself. It's like, James Lipton said I changed the world. It's okay.
That's crazy.
What is besides hosting a television show? What is his actual? He's Dean, right?
Yeah, he was Dean.
What does he do? What does he do?
He auditioned. Like when Ellen Burstyn was in my audition.
Ooh.
When I auditioned. And I was a really snarky, mouthy 21-year-old.
What were your audition pieces?
Oh, my goodness. What was the audition piece? I don't remember the audition piece. I remember what happened. So I did my audition. And James Lipton stands up and says, 21 is an awfully young age to have a life's philosophy. And in my essay, To Apply, I wrote that I believe theater has the power to change. I had studied a lot of Brecht and a lot of Augusto Boal, and this idea that theater is an alive, actionable thing that inspires people. And so Lipton said, that's a young age for life's philosophy. And I said, I'm going to get my MFA with or without you.
Whoa.
And I walked out the room.
Whoa.
That, right? Like, in my mind, I was like, that's like a movie moment.
That's
crazy. I did that. Like, I said, like.
And then you got it.
And then a week later, I got my acceptance letter.
Oh, shit.
Do you think that charmed them, or was your audition that good? Or was it a combination?
Can I be honest?
Yeah.
Like, I look back at my work then, and I was like, I'm definitely a better actor now. I'm right. able to be more present moment to moment, internalize a character, in my opinion. So I, in my mind, I look at all my work and I go, oh, it was okay. So I think my self-assuredness mm-hmm. definitely helped. And I think I gave a decent audition.
Yeah.
I got in and, yeah.
So you got the you go through this whole very strenuous acting program.
Yes.
Right? And then when did you start doing comedy? Was that something that happened after, or was it happening simultaneously?
It happened right after. In undergrad, I did some short form, and then I decided upon graduation. I graduated undergraduate early. I decided I wanted to be a serious actor, because mm-hmm. when you're 20, everything's serious. And then I graduated my MFA program. I was like, why was I serious for 3 years?
Right.
And so I started doing comedy performances. I did a spank with a friend. He's now a friend, but then he was just a guy I met at a callback for a short form improv company.
So was that your first experience at UCB, was performing there?
Yeah.
Oh,
was
wow.
My first experience was a spank. And I just remember going, this feels good.
Interesting.
And then I started taking classes shortly thereafter. And this was before there was this nice, lovely training center, or the one before that. And I just remember being in class and not, like, this probably was 2007-ish. Yeah. And I remember being in class and not feeling like I was super supported or felt welcomed or my voice was valid. And it was less the teacher's fault. It just felt like I wasn't invited to hang out. I wasn't invited right. to participate in the community.
So you very much experienced the kind of things that people approach you about now.
Absolutely. And I stepped away from the community for 2 years. I stepped away and I did long form improv with degenerates and wonderful people and drag queens and all sorts of walks of life in the Lower East Side.
Let me ask you this. So you said your first experience was doing a spank. Did you see an improv show that led you to taking classes, or did you just end up knowing about this program and taking classes?
Well, because I started...
You had seen improv before.
I'd seen improv, and I was just like, I want to do this. Like, I love improv. I've always... Like, it was one of the first performing things I did.
Okay.
I started out in undergrad pre-med biochemistry, because in my mind, I was going to be a gastroenterologist. Didn't happen.
You could have done it.
I know, right? Like, I'd be up in that liver so good.
You'd be like, I'm getting my doctorate without you. With or without you.
Now bend over. But I ended up doing a play my first semester of college, and my dad was like, that's the first time I've seen you like come alive. And it was a David Ives play, so it was a comedy. And so the first time my dad actually saw me kind of be me was on stage in
doing
a comedic play. Yeah. And then I started doing improv right after that. And so years later, I knew that, like, I was like, there's no doubt in my mind I'm going to do improv. I'm going to do sketch. Like, there was no doubt I was going to do comedy.
So you made up your mind that you were going to do improv and sketch kind of independent of UCB.
Yeah.
And you showed up to UCB in your first class experience and, like you said, didn't feel welcome and stepped away from the community after the first class?
I took 3 classes, I believe, because I took classes with Joan Wengert, mm-hmm. Doug Moe,
Bad Dad,
Shannon.
Mm-hmm.
And there was someone else probably. And I took all those classes and I just, like I said, it wasn't necessarily the teachers, but I didn't feel welcomed by the student body, or I felt like, and this is something that I was able to actually have an amazing conversation about this DCM, was it's exhausting to feel like you have to fight for space on stage.
It really is, yeah.
That, like, I showed up. That should be enough. And, like, I'm going to work on getting better. You work on getting better. But it shouldn't be a fight for how I identify to be a part of space.
Yeah, and I also think that, like, if you fight too much for too long, I think two things happen. I think one is you start to assume that they're right and that you don't have anything valid to say. And then the back half of that is that then when you do get space, you don't know how to deliver with it.
Yeah.
Because you've gotten so bad at actually being able to follow through on your own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I think it can have long-term damage if you put up with it too long.
I agree. And I really love the idea of inclusiveness, like authentically, like, which is why regardless of who I'm talking to, I assume they have so much uniqueness to bring to anything they do. And I try to afford that to the people I interact with. So when I don't get that back, I usually have a, oh, this feels weird.
Yeah.
Because I assume people are complex. I may not know all your complexities. That's fine. You don't have to share them with me. I just would like the respect that I am a complex individual as well, even if we don't agree.
Right. And there's also the element of these people are under bits of pressure on their own and maybe won't be. Maybe they're acting in a way that's like, okay, these people are accept. You know, like, we're not as willing to go out on a limb and be the real people we are when we're in situations mm-hmm. where it's like there's something we have to conform to in this class or whatever. Because I find that, like we were saying before, a lot of that stuff is almost accidental. Like, if
yes.
you really were to say, like, hey, why aren't you including this person or why aren't you nice to this person? They'd be like, oh, my God, I didn't even
think about it. Which is hard because it's like a lack of inclusion by omission isn't good either.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which is why I think it's important to empower people to take up space and provide an awareness that it's that you're not a bad person. However, you have to be mindful that you will default to normal constructions. You'll default to what your experience is, the limitations at times your experience, if you don't make a decision to be intentional to include people.
Right.
I think it's a decision I try to actively make to include people, which is why when people come up to me, I try to actively include them because I know there's a conversation happening.
And I also think, you know, stuff like the diversity program is
yeah.
making the conversation more towards people tending towards doing that. Like, I think people are more willing to include people now just because the entire community has kind of changed.
Yes.
I also think there's a slightly damaging idea that, like, deliberate diversity is insincere. Like, if you go mm-hmm. out of your way to include people, you're like,
can I say
people,
that yeah. I used to be one of those people that also
yeah.
thought that?
I know.
And when I realized I was wrong was when I started to realize that, like, no matter what the situation is, it's mostly about the next generation. Like, because, yeah, maybe we're in a way forcing people on stage, whatever that we consider that, but people that come to shows and see them on stage, that's where I've started to see the benefit. Like, in the last few years, seeing students that have come to the UCB and only known a UCB where there are a bunch of black people performing, I think that's where it starts to be different. And that was what changed my mind on the whole thing.
I agree with you. I also think the other reason why it's necessary to be deliberate about it is because if I had no conscience in making my choices, I would pick a lot of improvisers who remind me of me.
Right.
Both demographically and also style-wise and also I would pick nerdy, probably short, young women, mostly from the East Coast, who like books mm-hmm. and were late bloomers.
And
like that, I like that demographic.
Yeah.
If I don't challenge that, that's all I'm going to do. So sometimes it's like, to get people who are good, you have to be deliberate about
right.
it.
Mm-hmm. And you're not a bad person. We have bias. Bias is real. it's an awareness of what do you do with that bias.
Right.
Like, I'm not saying, how dare you have bias? It's thank you for being aware of your bias and bigger than your bias, and try to include people and realize that there's still unconscious bias we all have, and that, like, it's a cool thing to get bigger than that.
Let's talk about what brought you back to UCB.
Well, actually, before we do, okay, I want to talk about what you were doing in the East Village in between those 2 years.
Sure, sure, sure.
Because that sounds very much like an I'm going to do it with or without you.
Yes. And that's very much my attitude in life, that sometimes you got to get it done and there's all different places to grow and change. And I really do love all kinds of people because I think I have a limited experience, so I want to engage with, like, all different people. And I got a chance. My good friend John Murdoch, who is a crazy erotic balloon artist. We went on this weird audition for a sketch group, and the sketch group, we all got in, and then we were all like, I don't know if we want to keep doing this sketch group. So the rest of us, we formed an improv troupe that performed above Lucky Chang's when it was in the East Village. And so we had queens who would, like, do a show downstairs and run up and do a show with us. And it was called God Tastes Like Chicken. And the construction behind it is we wanted to tackle the hypocrisy and the misogyny that exists in religion by being the zealots of religion in an abstract way. So we made up this religion where our chicken was our God.
Oh, boy.
Because what does chicken taste like?
Everything. Everything, right.
Yes. And so that was our metaphor, God tastes like chicken. And the improv portion was the purging of our sins. It was the purging of our sick thoughts, ideas in improv form. So we'd take a suggestion and we'd do this, and we'd come out in robes and we'd do that. And we'd also put on sketches that were passion plays. One of my favorites was Jesus is a Zombie, and it was Mother Bloody Mary. And it was a nun who came out but would fight Jesus with a ruler, and we had blood packets, and the audience had to wear garbage bags because we sprayed blood everywhere. Blood was everywhere.
This sounds like a Billy Merritt, like, class show from, like, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. That sounds super fun. And, like, when you're doing it, are you loving it? Is it something where you're like, this is weird?
There's a part of me, and this is what I think the way I came to comedy and came back here in terms of community. I fucking love weirdos.
Mm-hmm.
I love weirdos. And I don't think this idea of being alt or different or strange has anything to do with what you look like or where you come from or necessarily how you identify. It's something that's deeper, and that's what I loved about it.
Mm.
Because it was like, oh, I love how you don't think like how I think or like how they think or like anybody else. And I think that's amazing. So I love people who I meet. And I go, you don't think like anybody else. And thank you. Thank you. Because we need you. Because you're going to provide awesome, interesting thoughts. So I did that for a while. The group, we just kind of lost steam as a group. And everybody went different ways. And unfortunately, some people started dating.
And then that ends.
And then, you know, when that doesn't go well, sides and blah, blah, blah. And that's when I decided to start taking classes at UCB again. It was about 2009. And I tried to do something that, like, I didn't want to come back to UCB and just complain. I wanted to be actively involved in the diversity program. So when I found out there was one, decided that I was going to take an active role in that. And that's where I met Nicole and Sashir.
Right.
And that's kind of how I really came back to the community.
So you came back with the sort of thing of, like, I'm coming back, but I mean, the last time you were there, you were kind of affected by, you know, the not, I wouldn't say non-diversity, but you were kind of affected by the culture of the theater. So you're like, let me come back and affect the culture of the theater.
Yes.
And came back in. That was like something you were doing. And then taking what class? Where did you come back? What do you
I started back at level one because I wanted to really be good. I didn't, because I'd left at 301, I didn't decide to like just continue. I thought, you know what? It's important that I really embrace it and come back into the community.
Wow.
And like that was very important to me, and I'm really happy I did, and I had so many good experiences doing that, and I feel like I learned a lot by doing that.
So at this time, like you said, you met Nicole and Sashir.
Yeah, Nicole Byer and Sashir is the man.
Now, you guys are on the podcast as a group, right?
Yes.
Long time ago, but that was like in the middle of it. Now we have a little bit of perspective, and let's just talk about Doppelganger. For those students that don't know, there was a time where, you know, UCB was a little bit different. But I think that there's a before and after Doppelganger. Because when Doppelganger came on the scene, things changed. I remember watching shows and being like, this is, I can't even believe what's happening. Like, and it sounds crazy to say, but to see three black women on stage at UCB winning cage match consistently and being hysterical was, I mean, seemed unheard of. It seemed unheard of to me, as a, even as an African-American student who was like, you know, in the community. That was such a huge time and huge moment. What was that? I mean, looking back on that now, what was that experience like? Like, was, did it, I mean, is it something that you look back on? You're like, I couldn't even think about, you
it
know?
Was magic. Like, yeah. It was literally magic. I got to play with Sashir and Nicole during DCM, and it was magic. It's, I step on stage with them to do improv, and I know it's going to be magic. And it was the first place I've ever had as, like, a performer in an improv setting where I stepped on stage and I felt like I can do anything.
Yeah.
I can be 100% me.
And like you were saying, weirdos, like three people who,
yes,
like commit to being super weird and super crazy. I want to say one thing. The first cage match, I think I was there. You guys went first, and it was against. I'm trying to remember. It's hard to even remember.
It turned into Airwolf.
Yeah,
Badman.
Badman. So this was, you know, at this point, I don't think people have heard of Doppelganger. And this was before indie cage match. So for this kind of unheard of team to get into cage match was like crazy. I believe there's a story behind how you guys got in.
Well, Nicole wrote a very strongly worded email that was like, we're really good. Trust us.
And Charlie took a chance and put you guys up against Badman, which was like a very, very good team. I mean, lots of great improvisers.
Were you guys practicing weekly as a,
yes,
team at that point? And who was your coach?
Ashley Ward. We were actually, as soon as we started, the first time all three of us performed, it was such magic that we were like, let's do every show. So we did like anywhere between 3 and 7 shows a week.
Wow.
And we just kept getting better and really supporting each other. And then like Ashley was working with us. And this was all as a result of not getting on to Harold. We didn't get onto Harold, so we were like, let's do this.
Right.
And so we performed very aggressively for weeks and weeks and weeks. Then we got cage match, and we just practiced to the form, and we did us, and we celebrated what we do, and we did organics,
yeah,
three-person organics, and we had a kind of a code of, like, what makes a doppelganger set,
yeah,
and I won't necessarily share that, but we have an internal language of, we know it's a doppelganger set if
these things happen.
These things happen. And so that for me was really helpful to have like a code of conduct of like, we're going to do these things to make it a good set. And if we do that, regardless if we win or lose, we've done our job.
So let me just say, this first show, you guys went first and came out. I don't think I might have known Sashir. I don't think I knew you. I don't know if I knew you guys at the time, actually. But this was one of those sets where when we talk about improv magic, that thing, that intangible you can't really like place, there was something going on stage. Like you were saying, it was kind of a celebration of all the work you guys had been doing. There was like this electricity with the laughs and the audience and the it was one of those things where afterwards when Badman tried to perform, I remember feeling like...
You just said tried to perform.
It was hard.
Wow.
Because Doppelganger had scorched the earth. Like that was the way I had used it in my stage. I was like, in my head, I was like, no one can perform after what just happened. And it was tough. The audience was like, man, we just saw some magic, man. It's going to be hard to beat that. And I just remember that moment being like so blown away. And I mean, it wasn't 1 week. It wasn't a fluke. You guys consistently did it for weeks.
How long was your run? Do you remember?
7 or 8 weeks. And
wow.
Then we ended up having an independent run at the UCB East.
Yeah.
And we pushed ourselves after a conversation with Neil Casey and Anthony Antamanik to start doing 3-person, 45-minute to hour-long sets. And it was amazing. And I think it just helped us like... get really good. And yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Like you know, we hadn't played together in a very long time. And so when we got together for DCM and it was 100% magic and it was everything that a doppelganger show still is, I was like, yay.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean, that was an awesome time. And it was one of the first indie teams I'd ever seen go in and win. Multiple wins. I mean, it was incredible. And at the time, I mean, Doppelganger became something everyone was talking about. You three became superheroes in the diversity community here mm-hmm. at UCB. It was unbelievable. And yeah, you know, we see ripple effects of that even now with the astronomy clubs and your Take It Personal shows. Things changed after that. And I remember it. It was incredible. So Doppelganger's happening. You guys are having a ton of fun. You're doing shows now at UCB. So you're starting to really feel like you're in the community.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of what has led me to here is like I've started to, maybe it was 2010 we started. I think Doppelganger started summer of 2010, something mm-hmm. like that. And, or spring, excuse me. And that's when I really start to feel like I did have a place in the community on my own terms. And
yeah, it was like you're saying, you took up your own space. You made your own space.
Yeah. And I would be lying to say that it's still not a struggle to take up my own space and to remind myself that my voice is valid because I didn't, like, we used to joke, Doppelganger, that, like, you tend to go to a young white 20-something male crowd and it's Star Wars, Star Trek. For us, it was God and Jesus mm-hmm. because we were three black women and that's like the church
that's
is something.
Your Star Wars.
The church is just something around there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at a lot of black entertainment, like the idea of church and God is in a lot.
And I think that was part of the reason that Doppelganger was so incredible to watch is because you guys were doing scenes about stuff that no one else was fucking with. Like,
yeah.
No one else was getting close. That was amazing. Talk about transitioning from that to being more into the, like, house team system, doing Lloyd Knight. What was your experience there? I mean, you've had a ton of experiences on both Lloyd and Harold at this point.
Were you on Lloyd at the very... Was Hoops at the very beginning?
I was on one of the first Lloyd teams. That was interesting. So, because it was... like transitioning into Lloyd, and I was like, okay, what is this? And I was also put on another house team at another theater.
Right.
And it happened at the same time, and it was very stressful, and it felt, made me feel like I had, like, there was just a lot of tension, and I had health issues. Like, I have a lot of non-visible disabilities,
mm-hmm.
and so I was having a lot of health issues, and it was a very interesting experience. It was, like, there were a lot of good people on the team. We just didn't mesh.
Right.
Like, we just couldn't get it. And then I took some time off, and I decided I wasn't going to audition for Harold again. I wasn't going to audition for Lloyd or Harold again.
Mm-hmm.
Until after Hoops?
After Hoops.
Because were you cut from that team?
I was cut from Hoops, and then I had a couple of the, like, invited-only auditions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I had felt really good about them. like everyone I had, and I didn't get put on a team. And I just came to a place where it's like, for me, it wasn't, it didn't feel good to feel like I was doing the work I wanted to and not getting where I want. So I decided not to audition.
And I think it's easier to make those kinds of decisions when you're ingrained in the community in the way. I mean, you're already teaching at this point.
Yeah,
right?
I was teaching at this
point. You're teaching, you're performing with Doppelganger. I mean, you can make the decision to be like, you know what, this isn't right for me right now. Step away. It always, anytime someone has said that on the podcast, it kind of ripples with me as like, well, that's crazy. But then I'm always like, no, if it's all about perspective.
But also I wonder if having Doppelganger makes a bit, like you have probably the best creative outlet.
Yeah. Right.
Most likely you're ever going to have in this team, at least as far as you knew at that time.
Well, I also think like a friend of mine said, it's go where you're wanted. And yeah. I think creatively, as an artist, like I love improv, and you know, at that time, it didn't feel like that was for me. Mm-hmm. And I will go where I'm wanted, and I believe there's an audience and a place for me, even if that's in or out of the house team system. Mm-hmm. I genuinely believe that I have a lot to offer the world, that I don't have to do that.
I mean, that comes from that same confidence of with or without you, by the way. But go ahead, Nicole.
How do you negotiate balancing when you need to go where you're wanted versus make your own space and take up your own space?
Well, for me, it's how much do I want to try?
Yeah.
Because I write down how much I want to try. If I don't feel like I'm getting the feedback I struggle because I don't want this to sound egotistical, but if I don't feel like I'm getting the recognition or the support I need, and I know my worth, I try to make sure I have a sense of my value as a performer. And I believe everyone has value, and it evolves, it ebbs and flows. So if I don't feel like I'm getting the recognition or the support I need for the value I have, like in business, time to walk away.
Yeah.
Time to change, time to pivot.
And you said the support you need, not the support you want, because those are two different things. You need just a certain level of support to feel like you're doing something and not feel like, oh, well, do I have to change the way I'm being in order to like fall in line? Or no, that's a totally valid point.
I think that's a really, really important distinction, because it's not about feeling and it's not about ego. It's about like being able to be functional as an artist.
Yeah. And that being on a house team is amazing. I love it. However, you can be a high-functioning artist and create incredible work without that.
Mm-hmm.
And that if one starts to impede on the other, then you really have to examine what you're doing and like look at what you want.
Well, where we run into problems with that with students that I talk to is that you have the experience of knowing that you can go out and do that. Whereas a lot of students, their only experience performing is UCB or very limited outside of UCB. So, yeah, it's like you put all your eggs in that basket. I mean, I think this is the overall theme of every single podcast we record. Mm-hmm. It's like if you put all your eggs in this basket, you probably won't end up with the basket. But you know what I mean?
Like, well, I also think it's like know your worth.
Yeah.
A lot of I think we all struggle with that. I talked to some performers who I look at them and I go, oh, man, you're so amazing. And they struggle with that idea, totally. Like knowing your worth. And when then it's like, I'm worth more. It's okay. It's a constant conversation. And so for me, I decided not to audition again until James III.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into this.
Asked me if I'd want to do an all-black team. And I said the only way I would audition for Harold or Lloyd again is if I was auditioning with an all-black team.
You had said that before he approached you?
No, I said that when he approached you.
and he approached you with, let's start a team so we can audition. Was that how it worked?
Yep.
And
it was a year out from Harold. We didn't do this like a month before, a full year.
You guys did shows, practiced weekly.
And it was for the goal of being made a team. Like we literally sat down and we're like, okay, we have time. Let's do this.
This to me, again, is like one of those major, major moves that I think has huge rippling effects. One, Astronomy Club, when they became a team, almost maybe double the amount of black people that were on house teams ever. Maybe more than doubled.
Gotta be more than doubled.
I mean, it changed. I mean, along with the, I think there were three other black people added that same audition, Gary, Zach Cherry, and Amane. But that was so huge. And just like Doppelganger, watching Astronomy Club perform, I had said this to them and whoever was coaching them, but like, they're doing Heralds that no one else can do. And like, it was crazy. I mean, and I had many black students or diverse students that was their favorite team. And maybe it's, you know, they're speaking their language or I don't know what it was, but that was such a huge moment. Talk about what that was like going through the process of practicing, getting on as a team. Like, was that a huge,
well,
did it feel huge at the time?
It felt huge because we were falling in love with each other. I'd be lying to say that there wasn't a process of, we played and we fell in love with each other, and that it was amazing because in a team we were able to explore the black diaspora. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, this idea of being black means one thing. When you have on Astronomy Club people who identify as so many different things, half the team is multiracial.
Right.
And no one would think about that as a part of it. We come from different economic backgrounds, educations, experiences. And so for me, it was just a very great, magical thing to rehearse and to be able to explore these issues or not, to be able to say things or not.
I mean, that was another great part about Astronomy Club, too, is they could go out and do whatever, you know, they could do something that we recognize as like, oh, yeah, everyone has done this kind of scene. What's the real difference? Oh, but they can also add this layer. That is incredible.
And I mean, I see a lot of, and again, this is just an observation. I feel like to observe and critique, that doesn't mean I want to take it away. I see a lot of humor that serves a white culture.
Right.
I see a lot of mentions of like things that aren't necessarily inclusive in terms of their references, that the experiences of being an upper middle class, privileged, typically white person, it isn't a lot of the things I see. Just the value judgments, the experiences. And when you're not that, it can be hard to negotiate. And that's okay for it to be hard to negotiate. And my feeling is there's still a place for you at UCB.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be the thing that makes you not want to come to UCB, study, train, play. Which is why I think it was so magical for me, because I had to look at things from different points of view. Like, we had a show once and someone brought up the fact that they were like, I'm not sure if that was a fair representation to homeless people. And it was a good conversation to have of like, let's authentically talk about that in a meaningful way, that like, it is very important to us that we punch up because we do not want to be a part of the problem.
Right.
And it was very subtle, and a lot of people probably missed it. However, for us, it became like a moment.
You guys were
of,
more sensitive to it.
Yeah, and I think that's good.
And that must be such a different working environment to come off stage and realize you can say that and know it'll be honored as part of a conversation and not like, I'm going to be a killjoy.
Yeah, I mean,
because I feel like so often, to bring conscience into improv is considered like a buzzkill.
And we live in a world, this art form evolved in a way that was supposed to be sociopolitical.
Right.
And for me, we should be able to tackle that. It shouldn't be scary to us. We should be able to address all those things. And in a way that's playful and interesting that we can unpack, that we, like, you're allowed to laugh at the complexities of race, of gender identity, of norm. Like, we're allowed to laugh at those things, especially if we're punching up and exploring them.
For you, how much of it is in the things... I'm trying to figure out. Sometimes I worry that, like, when I bring my real voice and real point of view about those things to scenes, either I'm being a buzzkill or I'm pandering to people who agree with me, who are in the room, is a thing that I worry about or feel guilty about. For you, how much of it is either in what your character is saying, or is your point of view built into the kind of unusual things you explore or the kind or like built into the fabric of the scene itself?
I wrote an article about it on a website, Femsplain. I gave up shame, and I do not shame myself for being unique or having a unique experience. So if I'm playing at the top of my intelligence with my truth and not trying to pander to anybody, it will come out. I don't try to force it. I'm not going to deny it. Like, if that's what's in my brain, that's what's in my brain. I've stopped trying to, I've tried to kill that editor of appropriateness, because I was like, if I'm being a buzzkill, well, you need to work out some things.
Right, because what's in your brain should be a part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Whether it's pandering to whoever or not, especially when it's not.
But I think it's only, I mean, I think I accuse myself of it, but it's only pandering if you don't mean it.
Yes.
Right.
And that's the thing I try to do. And because I used to censor myself that way. And then I had that realization of that's a part of the problem. I am me. There's other me's. I'm not like any other person on this planet right now. So to try to put on this costume of normal within UCB, I think is like, meh.
Yeah.
Like, that's not fair to my teammates, and that's not fair to myself. So I try to avoid that.
And also, somebody else can do that. So why are you there if you're going to do a thing that you don't mean that somebody else could just
right,
do
anyway? So genuinely could do, right?
So I want to ask about, so you guys build Astronomy Club. You're playing together for a year. You fall in love with each other. Is there any concern as you're approaching that first audition and know that you're going to take this thing that you love and lay it in front of UCB to evaluate and to...
Of course, we were incredibly nervous. We made a promise to each other that we'd keep performing. We still perform.
Yeah.
And we're going to spank a show soon. Like, we're going to spank a sketch show, and we'd love to spank an improv show. We're not done. We still have a bond with each other. And I think that's the promise we made to each other, is that there's a level of wanting to need each other and needing each other, because everybody's so smart and different comedically on that team. Like, we are very diverse in playing styles and attitudes, even though we are an quote unquote all black team.
Right. Was there any pressure of of being the all black team? Are you thinking like, well, what does it look like to have a team that's all? Did you ever think about that? Was that ever?
Every time that entered my mind, I thought, how many all white teams have I seen?
That's
and
true.
Nobody, like, and I was like, every
I
time
I never
that,
thought about it. It's true. That question comes out of the normative.
Yeah. And I go, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm part of all black team. How many all white teams do I see? All right, I'm done. Yeah. Like, that's how I, or how many all dude teams have I seen? Like, I've seen.
Been a few, yeah.
Yeah. I remember the fucking Kennedys, and I remember going, whoa, lots of white dudes.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, and that's okay. So in my mind, I was like, if that's okay, then it's okay that I'm creating this space, because it should be. Because if we're really, like, being accepting of each other, it should be okay that I'm able to be on an all-black team. And it's just a thing, just like there's all white teams, right. And that's a thing.
Do you have any favorite moment, like any Astronomy Club moments where it's like, ooh, that was a standout big moment? I mean, I've seen some really good shows.
Okay, I don't know if I'll blow out a specific person spot, but I would be lying to say there's not something incredibly powerful and dropping the N-bomb on white audiences. I'd be lying.
Amen.
Because it's a word that white people should not even think they could be allowed to tell me how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word where it's like, you're going to tell me how to use that word. You need to shut the fuck up. I was like, you're not allowed to tell me. So when I use it, and I have my authority, my experience, there ain't nothing you're going to say.
Yeah. That, I mean, I will say that there is something that is so crazily weird about saying that, the power that it has, and the power that we know that we just aren't going to be offensive. Like, we can't be that offensive saying it. It's an incredible... well, crazy thing.
And it reminds me of like this is, it's fun and authentic to our experience. And that is not everybody can use all language all the time, right, and be considered okay or PC. You can't. You can use it, sure. First Amendment, we can chat all day about that. However, that doesn't mean you should.
Right.
There's things you can do, but it doesn't mean you should
do them.
And so recently at DCM, the only cast member who's never dropped it on stage dropped it.
Oh.
And on stage we all went. Like, the audience had no clue. Audience had no clue
that this was a thing for you guys.
Yeah. And so everyone else at some point had dropped it because, again, like I said, there's a power in saying, this is our experience. What you gonna do about it?
And when
nothing.
And when you're doing scenes that are more geared towards your experience, it's something that might come up more naturally than in a Star Wars scene.
Yeah. And I am. Yeah. It's so when that happened, it was a beautiful moment on stage where everyone else was aware that this one person had never said it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if they had ever said it before, ever.
Wow.
Really.
Wow.
So we all went, like, and then we doubled down, and as...
By double down.
I scream, nigga, 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 nigga at the front row. And I regret nothing.
Ladies and gentlemen, the podcast has just been shut down. Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, and we forgot to ask, but there were some amazing doppelganger moments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was there a moment that's a huge standout for you, maybe from the cage match run? I mean, does it there, also involve
the
N-word?
I have one moment that does not sound funny whatsoever, and it's one of my favorite scenes. Mm. It's not funny whatsoever. It's about imprinting and domestic abuse.
Interesting.
And I love it because there was a level of truth and honesty played to it. Sashir was the mom, and Nicole and I were playing, and we were beating each other. And we were just like, we weren't physically beating each other. We were verbally abusing each other. And Sashir's like, can you please just be quiet as she's cooking dinner? And we're like, we're only playing like you and daddy play. Right? And so we were screaming abuse, and then I roll out of the scene and I walk in as the dad.
And you just...
After Sashir spills the food on the floor, and I close the door and I point to the other door.
Oh, man.
And I walk her off stage. And then I come back and I roll back into one of the child roles. And Sashir does this wonderful verbal bit.
Oh, my God. And
the kids were just standing there stunned, not saying anything, looking at each other and out. As
she played both characters.
After we
was this
back,
cage match?
I believe it
I
was.
I think I might have seen this.
And then we are just stunned. We are just being there stunned, like taking each other in as this. And then all of a sudden you hear, I can't believe you, da 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 da. And punch, 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 slam, silence. And we hold silence for a few seconds. And the audience is like, ah! And we're just playing the truth of it. And then we headed into
something else, which is really funny.
Yeah.
Wow.
However, it was really, really like one of those powerful moments. And why it was my favorite moment is like there was something very truthful and a painful truth.
Yeah.
And so I love those moments because when you get to tackle real pain, but be funny and interesting and nuanced and truthful and grounded in it, you like that. I could watch all day because then it kind of resonates with you and you think about things and you're like, you start to go, why is that funny? Like,
you've said that a few times. You've mentioned truth as something that you to have as a tool with you on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been recently trying to think about like what makes a good game. I've been asking around what people think. And like, that's one of them is like truth is a, like there are certain games that have great element, like a lot of truth and some that don't. And there is a significant difference. Do you find that you're a person that is tending towards trying to use truth in all your sort of improv?
I think my preference is I like truth. truth doesn't mean I can't be goofy or weird or strange.
Totally, totally.
I like watching truth when I watch improv.
Let's talk about teaching just a little bit. You've been teaching inside and outside of UCB for a while. You teach high school improv. You do a lot of sort of that kind of thing. Is that one of the things that you're tending towards? Is that one of the notes you give a lot? Or what's your general sort of philosophy when you're talking to someone about improv?
With the high school kids, for me, especially if I'm working with organizations where a lot of these kids come from really hard circumstances that no kid should come from, no adult should come from. They're just hard. For me, I love the process in improv where speaking to the top of your intelligence is really translating your own thoughts and intelligence out of your mouth. And so what a lot of I'm teaching is a 101 thing, and that's so much of 101 is being able to translate your thoughts, the way you think and how you feel. So for me, what I love in my philosophy is, like, if they never become improvisers, the fact that they're able to negotiate their thoughts, which they live in a world where they're not supposed to think thoughts. They live in a world where all their thoughts are criminal. They live in a world where so many of their thoughts are geared towards survival, that they have a space just to process what they think in a fun and playful way is amazing.
So just getting their thoughts out, getting their truth out, whether they're becoming comedians or not, it's just being able to, like, get that out and communicate it.
Yeah. And, you know, it is for the purpose of comedy. However, the negotiation lasts longer than that. Like, some of these kids I've worked with over a year, and I've seen them be able to process themselves in a deeper, more meaningful way. Mm. That it is a privilege to be able to give in space and energy to communicate yourself, to communicate about yourself. It is a privilege to be able to journal, to talk about your...
Reflect in a sort of constructive way.
And so for me is you get to see them do that in a fun way where they're not playing their everyday stakes of life. They just get to play their experience. And for me, I find that really valuable because regardless of, like, they keep taking classes here or not, they come out being able to say, huh, I never noticed I felt that way. Or just speaking is okay. Just being able to speak my thoughts is okay.
And when you are teaching classes here with normal adults, how much of that are you bringing in? Or how much does your strategy change going from high schoolers to adults?
I think it's similar. I mean, what's nice is the curriculum's slightly different.
Right.
Because, like, a lot of those are just, like, closer to one-off workshops or very, like, pointed workshops where we don't have the same amount of time. I love teaching the 101s, the 201s, a little bit of the 301s and 401s. Because in 101, it's very interesting to see people just process the concept of yes and, which we do it all the time. It's that part that we forget how exciting it is. I think you talk to enough people who've been improvising long enough, you forget how exciting it is to change your mentality to yes and. And it's not the same as any other way of thinking.
Yeah. Anytime I was starting to feel slightly burnt out from teaching, and I realized it's like, oh, I'm not teaching a 101. I started teaching this 101 and started watching people, like, fall in love with improv again and, like, don't have to have super high lofty expectations for them, but, like, just seeing them, like you said, process that initial thing that's like, oh, right, this is a game changer in along the lines more of, like, the way I process the world, not just improv. Yeah, that's totally true. Do you find that you still love teaching? Because you've been teaching a long time.
Yeah, I love teaching.
You don't ever feel an element of getting burnt out? Because that's something I think...
Oh, I absolutely, like, need breaks sometimes, like, just for life, like,
right,
life stuff. And to make sure I'm, like, doing my own writing and doing my own projects and, like, really putting my energy where I need to. So, however, I'm never burnt for long. It's usually just I have to get my life together. So I try to take time to feel like I feel settled and grounded in my life. So I can really just come and teach for 3 hours.
Mm. I was going to ask this before, as somebody that a lot of people, whether you've taught them or not, approach with their concerns, with things that are on their mind. Is that ever, and especially as somebody who receives it in such a present, aggressively empathetic way, is that ever something that is exhausting to you?
It's...
Do you ever feel like you have to, like, put up a wall to protect yourself? And also, I think, to protect other relationships in your life.
It's exhausting. I don't necessarily think I need to put up a wall. I just give people expectations. Like, if you're going to write me an email out of nowhere, don't expect an immediate response. I have other things that I prioritize. Like, I love my dad so much, and I've spoken on other podcasts about how much I love my dad. He talks about something that I really take to heart. There's a difference between urgent and important.
Wow.
And important has been lost with this idea of urgency in cell phones and technology, that we make a lot urgent that is not important.
Mm.
And it's really exhausting and sad. And that most of us don't give ourselves the time to go, is that important? Is this actually helping me towards the person I want to be? Or is it just urgent? So there's sometimes I'm not the fastest to respond to certain emails because they're frankly not the most important. And that might feel hurtful to people because we've lied to ourselves to think, but it's urgent.
Mm-hmm.
It must be important. And it's like, no, it's not. So if someone comes to me with a very important issue, I will make time and I will create a space sooner than I would if it's just quote unquote urgent. Sometimes things are urgent and important,
right,
and those take a different weight. But that's how I assess situations.
You don't take on other people's urgency if it's not urgent for you.
No.
Honestly.
I mean, that'll just wear you thin.
Yeah.
Wow.
Can I ask you some hypotheticals?
Yeah.
And maybe this can help with
this. Absolutely.
Let's get some of these things out there now. You probably have a bunch of students come to you and ask you, like, I'm a minority coming into UCB. What general advice would you give someone going through classes now?
Improv is hard.
Right.
And take up space. That is my motto right now, is take up space, that your voice is valid. Still do the work of improv. Just remember that your experience is your experience, and you don't have to, like, you shouldn't be ashamed of it or hide it. Your experience is your experience. And improv is hard. And don't let the hardness push you away from it. At the same time, if you can give people understanding that because this is improv and improv is hard, some well-meaning people say awful things. Also, take up space in the sense that if you see people not inviting you out or not wanting to participate with you, create your own support system or find people who really value you.
Right. Reach out to the people who share your interests, or
yeah,
there are diversity programs. There are just other people. Gravitate towards the people that want, like you said, you know when you're wanted.
Yeah. And that, I mean, not to get nasty, but, like,
right,
I mean, it's a similar thing of a relationship thing. Don't live someplace where somebody doesn't really want you.
Right.
Because that is exhausting. You feel terrible. They'll feel terrible eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So why do it?
Here's another question that maybe relates directly to that. As a teacher,
mm-hmm,
even if you're not a minority, you're a white guy or you're a, you know, whatever, how do you make sure that these things are fostered? How do you make sure that your classrooms are good for that? Because, like we're saying, go out and take up your space. But what if you have a teacher that's not encouraging that? How can you be someone that encourages that? Is that
as
something,
a teacher?
As a teacher, yeah. Or as a coach or any sort of position of...
Remember, you carry bias, and really be honest with yourself about the bias you carry. Be honest about your economic situation and what led you up to this. This idea of pure, rugged individualism is bullshit. You came from somewhere. You had a set of experiences that came from other people. You are not in full isolation. Because if you were raised in the woods, you learned how to speak,
right.
You fed yourself your whole time, then we could talk. But that is not how it happens. Even to get food day to day, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people that made it possible for you to eat. We are connected. So remember, you have had some privilege to get here. Be aware of your bias and privilege.
And try to curb it, or not even curb it, but just try to understand it and not let it be an accident when you're using it.
And to release shame around your privilege and bias. I am lucky that I was able to have economic support of my parents through college. I recognize that as a privilege.
Bias. Totally. That's totally
and that it. Not everybody has that, and that's fine. It does not make them more or less. Just makes them different. So I think it's important to realize that everyone has bias.
Right.
And that's okay. As a coach and a teacher, really check it. Really check it, because your bias can damage people.
Those are two great pieces of advice. I guess the one, you may not have an answer for this last one, but as a community, I mean, you came in and were instrumental in the diversity program, and we've seen how that's made huge waves. Is there another big step we need to take? And what do you think, is there anything that might lead us there? I mean, this is a question maybe we don't know the answer to, but I feel like if anyone does, you might.
I think there's steps we can take. I think it's really just being more intentional, being more mindful.
Right.
Being more mindful that it's better, but better's not enough. Like, I mean, you can look at any movements around social justice. We have first wave, second wave, third wave,
right.
Because we go, we did it. But it's never over.
Right. So the wave that I feel like we're in now is there's more black teachers, there's more diverse teachers, there's more diverse performers. But the next wave might, I'm not even sure what that is, but knowing that there is maybe more to go.
And there has to be another wave. So one of the things that has happened in business, I really am passionate about this construct. I'm really passionate about quote-unquote diversity. And learning more about like inclusion and the numbers. When people ignore inclusion, when they ignore keeping women involved, when they ignore keeping people of color involved, the numbers go down. Because we think we fixed it and it's not better. It's
right.
Just different. And that we have to keep...
You have to be vigilant or it will regress.
And it's a lie to think it's better, we're done. We have to keep getting better. Change isn't a destination, it's a journey, and we all have to get there as a comedic community. Because, I mean, I think it will have better comedy. I think we'll do better work. I think more people will find amazing voices. And I think to take responsibility that everybody who's a part of this comedic community, that like, I think it's like, awesome. You want to be a part of this comedy community. And I will try to negotiate everything else in terms of my bias and my prejudice to make sure that we really get on board with that goal. And I think if everybody can come to the table and go, you're in this class, or you're around, so you must have this like passion, love, and drive.
Right.
Let's support that together. And I'm going to be aware there are real challenges that are real. And for some people, dangerous and more than problematic, very serious. I can't believe we checked it at the door. I just have to remember that we're serving comedy first, and all those things really factor in, and I can't ignore them. I have to include the whole person, not just the pieces I want.
And I think a great point about that, too, is like recognizing the changes that we have made and the benefits we've seen from them.
Yes.
Like, you know, we should keep striving to be more diverse because doppelganger happened when we did. And, you know, certain, you know, I totally agree with you. And it's good to look back on the things we've done and know that that's just the beginning. And like you said, we've got to be vigilant. But I will say with the state of the community now, and I've said on Black History Month at Herald Night, like, UCB's doing pretty good. I mean, they're doing a damn good job of being proactive. And there's more steps to be done, but We'll walk that when we get there.
And I would put it out there as a battle cry to the community. It's all of our responsibilities.
Totally.
And take up space. If you notice someone that you have the ability to take up more space, start noticing people who aren't given the space they deserve. Mm. Like, take ownership of what you can do with your privilege to speak to other people who maybe have less awareness.
Totally.
Take ownership. If we're a community, we have to take group ownership over these issues. It's not us versus them. It's inclusion. So I think it's a radical idea to say everyone should care about it. But everyone should care about it.
Yeah. Hashtag take up space. I like that as kind of a, you know,
yeah,
soundbite,
yeah, like,
because it means exactly what it sounds like. It's like, yeah, take up that space and don't be ashamed of it.
Yeah. And I also think this is white person talking to white people, but also
please,
like, do it to do it, not for the reward or the recognition
right,
of having done it. You can do it and do it quietly, or you
yes,
can do it and have it change your behavior without it needing to be. Actions speak louder than Facebook posts, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well,
yeah,
let me just say that thank you so much for being here, Keisha.
Oh, thank you.
I feel like of the episodes we've recorded, man, we've really gotten into some super important stuff. I hope everyone listens to this because you have a great perspective on these types of issues. And as a accomplished improviser who also has that perspective, it's important that we have a voice for, you know, people of your ilk, because you've done so much for the community and like we've all reaped the benefits of it. And I hope we all recognize that it's the people who come to classes who don't feel like they were accepted, who end up coming back and making the change that we all want to see. It's not just going to happen. It happens when you go out and change it. And you've done a lot of that and been a part of some amazing, huge kind of revolutionary things at UCB, to call a team revolutionary, but you've been a part of some huge landmark things at UCB, and you'll continue to be around.
Yeah.
Keisha Zoeller, one of the greatest. One of the greatest.
Aww.
Thanks for listening, guys. You've been listening to the UCB Longform Conversation podcast. If you haven't already subscribed, go ahead and do that. And you can also go to iTunes and leave a rating or review. That would really help us out. In the future, if you want to ask us questions or ask questions to our guests, you can follow us on Twitter at UCB Convo and look for postings there on future guests and future activity. Guys, I'm feeding the nerds left and right. We'll see you next week.